concepts was this, that the laws of society should be made according to Shariat law.
Exactly.
I mean, in on the basis of how God defines the application of people's lives.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really then ordinary, it doesn't mean just the fact that the lead, the authority should be a religious authority.
Mm.
It means that religious authority should be in everyday life of the people.
Exactly.
That's what he was trying to conjure up in people's understanding.
That's right.
Hey, you don't need an authority with a stick.
No.
You need a stick to be the part of the whole system. Where so much so that people realize that they have a responsibility to each other,
quite.
Not only as personal interaction, but as a religious interaction.
Yeah.
In other words, for example, I could say as an ethical discussion, we could say is that, for example, a father, when he goes out working for the livelihood of his children, he shouldn't feel that he's doing a favor for his children, but he has a responsibility from the Almighty to do that for the kids.
That's right. That's
so that attitude Imam Khomeini wants to bring home, that everything that a society does, it should do with the aspiration that it is to fulfill God's obedience. And God's instructions.
Exactly, exactly.
And that is what Imam Khomeini is nurturing in these discussions. Of course, he goes to a very high level where he's defining the role of a wilayat al-faqih, in other words, the authority of a jurisprudence in the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
But in reality, he's trying to nurture a society of religious practices.
Exactly.
But by defining the absolute authority in that system.
Exactly.
And he does it very well. Mm-hmm. And he does it on, you know, this whole concept is developed in front of students, particularly in the 70s.
Yeah. Yep.
Early 70s in Najaf, where he's lecturing in this madrasa, and he's talking about the meaning of Hukumat Islami.
Exactly.
Islamic government.
This is the two big famous works that come out of those houses. The first is the Gnosis, the one that is the Jihad al-Akbar, the one that is to, you know, for that responsibility to be carried out properly by, as you say, a walayat al-faqih, a supreme jurist. He's got to have that training, that discipline to get rid of his nafsa amara, to be the example, the lead by which you look at him.
In fact, many
hadiths, as they say by the Holy Prophet, that you just by looking at him, you are reminded of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In fact, you're making a very good link here, the fact that, you know, Imam Khomeini is the only marja taqlid who says that in his line of conditions that a person qualifies for marja taqlid, he says one of the attributes of such a person should be that he should not have the desire for the world.
Exactly.
Once that etiyat wajib, that cautious compulsory caution, is the only one found in Imam Khomeini's rulings. It's not found in any other Maraja's ruling where it says etiyat wajib, he should not have worldly desires. That is a very interesting. Imam Khomeini is saying, even if you come to the level of a marja taqlid, the shaitan can come home to you.
Exactly.
But you should kick him out.
Kick him out.
And the only way to do that is, as a marja taqlid, you should not have this character in your heart either.
Aye.
You shouldn't think, okay, I'm becoming a marja taqlid, wow, I'm going to have so many people following me.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay?
But no,
that immediately is that world's desire, which Imam Khomeini reprimands. And this is a very good link you're making between the ethical discussions that Imam Khomeini develops in his
14th. And then this position of walaya.
And this position of wilaya.
Because
with the discussion of the wilayat al-faqih, I mean, this is a very important issue which Imam Khomeini, through his teachings, raises people like Sheikh Sadr from it.
Yes.
You know, Sheikh Sadr is that last component of his teachings who was shaheed in Iraq.
He says,
kind of drown yourself in Khomeini.
Drown yourself.
In one of his speeches, drown yourself in Imam Khomeini.
Mm.
So, you know, it's that absoluteness that he has in recognizing Imam Khomeini's... and what was his age? He wasn't in his 70s or 80s. He was 48 years old.
Yes.
You know,
and I like that, what you raised there, that drowning also, because there's mystical poems from Imam Khomeini about drowning with the beloved, you know, because he's talking about nothing but Allah. It's not even about himself. He's just wanting to see that the system is in place, as you say, of a society of pious people who are carrying out these edicts according to the Sharia, but the whole goal is to be with the beloved, isn't it?
Indeed. But then you see, being with the beloved doesn't mean that you abrogate all responsibilities for the world.
No, it
this
doesn't.
It's
putting it all in focus.
What is important is to understand that whilst Imam Khomeini was an advocate of mysticism, he was not an advocate of excommunication.
Excommunication, no, we're not talking about
you
that.
You see,
no,
because what Imam Khomeini, throughout his a poetical presentation of coming close to God was not that individual himself endeavors to come close to God. He should be a tool by which he could bring the society to God as well.
That's right.
And that's what Imam Khomeini replicated as being that manifestation of being that tool.
It's like putting everything in its right place, isn't it? Putting it all in the right context in terms of earning your money, going to your job, whatever it happens to be. But it's all, at the end of the day, to be in line with what is required to be a good Muslim.
Indeed. Hmm. So coming back to this, that the role that Imam Khomeini was trying to conjure up in the minds of his students was that they should have this idea of leading the Muslim Ummah towards God by implementing God's rules.
Yes.
So when he's teaching these things in the Hawza, he's quite clearly in the seminaries, he's quite clearly bringing this home to people. Mm. And other than that, of course, he was also teaching philosophy, and that in itself was a big headache for some ulema. Some scholars of the time.
Right.
I mean, I remember in one of his statements, he says that when I was teaching philosophy, some of the students used to wash the bowl from which my son used to drink water from. Mm. In the sense that some people felt that teaching philosophy was kofr.
Oh my goodness.
It was an act of an insult to Islam.
My goodness.
Because, of course, they did not themselves understand
the fact
the level by which one is using philosophy in understanding God.
Exactly.
And in understanding philosophy, there is a lot of discussion that if you're not capable of extrapolating those meanings from philosophical arguments, then you rather not go down that line at all.
Mm. And because the aspect that why Imam Khomeini is using philosophy is to put the rationale behind the system he was going to put in place, not only for what was happening in Iran, but for the whole Muslim world. I mean,
it was essential that through this, as you're pointing out, the rest of the world understands the character, the nature by which this movement is moving towards God. Creator must be conceptualized in its entirety, in his entirety.
Yeah.
So much so that we could say that this hukuma, this government, is under his supervision. Yes. If that is not realized, then yet again, such a character of a wilayat faqih would be again a dictator.
Exactly. It would be completely misconstrued.
And that's why Imam Khomeini says that where there's an existence of the wilayat faqih, it's a tool of removal of dictatorship.
Well, the thing is, this is the beauty, isn't it, of what he's setting out in his exile and in terms of what he's preaching in Najaf, in the Hawza. Although his immediate audience is the students, but he's going well beyond that to the masses and pointing out the fact that the people's participation in the system, they are saying yes to this system, removes the concept of dictatorship.
Yeah, but you see, when you're saying people at that time were interested in knowing what Imam Khomeini was doing outside.
Yeah.
You see, more and more of these lectures of Imam Khomeini were becoming cassettes and being smuggled into Iran.
That's right, yes.
They were becoming articles.
They called it the cassette revolution, in a sense,
And they were being smuggled into it.
Yep.
In other words, people wanted to remember what Imam Khomeini was standing for. They weren't ignoring the fact that he's now in exile. He's another Majid Taqlid sitting in Najaf or something like that. No, the aspirations to connect with Imam Khomeini's thoughts were still there. And that's why, when, as you pointed out, it became a people's revolt in wanting Imam Khomeini back rather than Imam Khomeini's desire to be back
because
to lead.
They began to understand, you know, the ideology, the rationale by which Imam Khomeini was taking the stand against not only the Pahlavi regime, but he also pointed out, even while he was in Najaf, that even the criminals that were there in power there, he said, your turn will be next. Things like this, you know, there were comments that, you know, this was something that was really going to revolutionize the entire Muslim world.
In fact, what Imam Khomeini said in a lecture to the Islamic Awakening people,
straight
after the revolution,
very interesting.
We expected
Egyptians
to revolt immediately. Mm. Because Imam Khomeini had sent a message of an ideological change.
Yeah.
A wave of ideological changes that were anticipated.
Yes.
But of course, we see it immediately after the revolution in Imam Khomeini, you had puppets like Anwar Sadat, who became an obstacle in these movements from coming to life.
Yeah.
You had Mubarak after him, then you had Ben Ali in Tunisia. Mm. They all became obstacles once Imam Khomeini's movement came to its full essence.
Yeah, and this was only because, of course, Imam Khomeini, in a sense, by what he had done and the fact that he gave such a a beautiful paradigm about how this system was going to function in Iran. Because this is the thing. This was what the unique thing that no other ulema and no other marja'i had done so far was actually to come up with a model. He was actually coming up with a model of how this system was actually going to function.
You see, Imam Khomeini was not really and truly creating something of his own.
No. But
Imam Khomeini, this whole concept...
He was putting the flesh onto it, wasn't he?
Not only just putting the flesh onto it, he was making people realize that this is not something out of the blue.
Yeah.
That it had always been within the theories of religious application
from the
of
school
society.
Of Ahlul Bayt, yes.
In the school of Ahlul Bayt, because of the fact that in the school of Ahlul Bayt, it did not neglect the fact that ulema would be a component in continuing the message of the Ahlul Bayt to the people.
There's a beautiful thing that you remind me of from Allama Mutahhari, Shaheed Mutahhari, one of the students of Imam Khomeini. Of course, he was martyred in the earlier years of the revolution by the Munafiqeen. And he points out beautifully three things that, you know, he was saying that the people needed in this day and age in order to make progress. And he said one of the things was that they need a school of thought that gives a progressive line in terms of understanding the concept of walaya, and through that walaya, the acceptance of that walaya, as it was in the past with the masumin, they have progress. They have prosperity and progress. And this was the thing that was so badly needed, because there was a vacuum in the Muslim world where many schools of thought were there but had reached a dead end because of various circumstances and various things that had happened. But briefly, Sayyidina, if you could say something about that
in the last minute or so about what we are seeing today. Why he's absolutely right is the fact that Shia opinion did not say that this leadership or the guidance of the ulema is something which is purely in the time of the occultation.
Yes.
During the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
In fact, it's been a process, which has successfully developed even in the time of Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib's time.
Yes, yes.
You know, sometimes people say that the faqih or the jurisprudence has only responsibility in the absence of the imam. But no, in the presence of the imam, a jurist was active. Who was that jurist who was active? When Mawla Amir al-Mumineen Ali ibn Abi Talib sent Malik al-Ashtar to Misr, he sent the most prominent scholar of his time.
Exactly.
To go to Misr and extrapolate on the needs of the people on the basis of the fiqh that Amir al-Mumineen had taught him.
Well, this is the thing about the beauty of this school of thought, isn't it?
Exactly.
The most knowledgeable, the most competent, the most...
Exactly.
You know, has the expertise to handle these
and
affairs.
And you see, I mean, just as a joke, you know, Imam Ali did not give Malik al-Ashtar a fax machine saying, if you're stuck, give me a fax, I'll give you a fatwa. No, he had the best qualities, the most competent to do that. And that's what we see.
These are people in their own right who can
indeed
do this.
But these individuals do not claim to be Masums.
No, they're not. No.
But they have the recognition of the authority of the Masum to apply over the people.
Exactly, the expertise.
And this is
there.
What Imam Khomeini was trying to articulate in the meaning of the Wilayat-e Faqih.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyidina. That was that's wonderfully concluded our program today. But we'll carry on with the next session, listeners, to the third phase of this very important revolution. But we'll do that in the next program. But thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all.
The last message of the late Imam.
Oh, you deprived people of the world. Oh, you Muslims and Muslim countries of the world, rise up and fight for your rights. Do not be afraid of the propaganda batteries of the superpowers and their mercenary agents. Drive out from your lands your wicked rulers who hand over your earnings to your enemies and the enemies of Islam. You yourselves and the dedicated public servants should take charge of the affairs of your country. Gather together, all of you, under the honoring banner of Islam, and fight the enemies of Islam and of the deprived people of the world. Advance toward an Islamic sovereign government with so many free and independent republics. If you realize this, the arrogant powers shall retreat to their own places, and all the deprived people will come to inherit the earth and attain guardianship over it. Looking forward to the day when Allah's promise shall be fulfilled.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to be talking about some of the Islamic laws hovering around marriage or marriage-related questions, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy, like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, there's a woman with 3 children. You know, we all know that domestic violence
is unfortunately available somewhere. And, you know, this domestic violence may have made life unbearable for a woman.
Yes.
All right?
You're right.
What can the woman do? Can she, in fact, separate from her husband and take away the kids with her? Who should take custody of the children in that case?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The custody of the children actually rests with the husband. After the children attain the age of 2 and more, okay? As long as the kids are minor, they have not attained the age of 2 years old, okay? They have not become 2 years old. The husband and the wife share the responsibility. Both of them have the right of custody, okay? And when they turn 2 years old, then the right of custody is with the husband. And it's the responsibility of the husband to take care of the children, to provide for the children, and to live with them together. In the case of a divorce, for example, if a divorce takes place, then the husband has the right to take the children with him and deprive the wife of custody. Because according to Sharia, she does not have the right of custody, even if she's not in a economically speaking, she's not in a he is not in a good condition, but he has to take care and custody of the children.
Can the children live with their mother if they wish to?
You know, if the children, let's say, attain the age of puberty, okay?
Right.
If the children attain puberty, then they can decide for themselves as to who they should live with. For example, if a girl turns 9 years old, she is free. The girl is free after 9 years old. We speak about 9 lunar years, not 9 solar years, okay? After she attains the 9 lunar years, she is free to choose who she lives with, okay? She can live with her mother, and she can live with her father. The same is the case with the boys. If there are boys in the family, the boys, for example, when they attain 15 lunar years, they can choose to live with their mother,
yes,
and not with their father. The father has no right to stop them from going to and visiting the mother or living with them after they attain puberty, okay? But even then, before they attain puberty, the mother has the right to see her children. The mother has the right to see her kids, because staying in touch with your own children is a must. It's obligatory. And the father cannot deny the mother the permission or the possibility to visit, okay? The mother should be allowed to visit,
yes,
her own children when they are separated from each other.
I see. Okay, the wife wants to become pregnant, but we sometimes see that there is no such cooperation on the part of the husband, so the husband refuses to cooperate with her. Is it, you know, can the wife force the husband to stop using, for example, contraceptives so that they become pregnant, and or to impregnate her?
Well, none of the husband and the wife has this right to impose his wish or her will on the other side, okay?
Yes.
The wife wants to become pregnant and to have to give birth to a child. she cannot force her husband to impregnate her. That's not a right given to the wife. She cannot. She does not have this right to make her husband to do this. Okay, to impregnate her, and to make her to stop using the pills or the contraceptives or let's say the condoms or these things, because these are the things which are considered to be contraceptives.
Is it also applicable to the men? Like
the same is true with it. Yeah, maybe the wife does not want to have children because of some maybe problems or some excuses which may be valid or invalid. The husband cannot make her make his wife to become pregnant. Of course, none of them has this right. And of course, it's a matter of mutual understanding, mutual cooperation. Both of them should come to an agreement about this.
Yes.
They should decide together whether they should have any children or not.
Yes.
And of course, having children is always recommended. The families should not be afraid of having children, because it's not the father who provides for the child. God has guaranteed and has promised to provide for the child. And of course, if someone is fears that that he will not be able to provide the child or take care of the child, of course he is to a degree disappointed from divine mercy. Okay, because he does not believe, for example, that God is going to do something for him. If he improves his tawakkul, his confidence in God, of course God will help him in his needs.
Yes.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Sheikh Shabit, is it permissible according to the Islamic laws and Sharia for a woman to change her surname after her husband? Is it at all recommended?
It's neither recommended nor advised, okay? It's not, the Sharia does not have anything to say in this regard. Of course, if a woman is willing to change her surname or her name even, there is no objection to her. She can change her name and she can do anything with the name. And that changing the surname does not mean that she is going to change her father's name as well. Okay, her father will remain her father, and she will remain, the daughter of her father. She cannot deny her relationship to her father. But as far as changing her surname is concerned, of course, many families I know do this, not only in Iran but also in foreign countries. They want to change their surname after their husband's surname. Of course, it's permissible, but it's neither advised nor recommended.
I see.
It is permissible per se.
I haven't seen it in Iran, though. I mean, like, normally it's like customs that maybe they call the wife's surname by the husband's surname. But that is only the kind of customary type of let's say, calling, but it is not written down. Like, it's not like in the legal context or text, for example.
And the notary office or anywhere.
Yeah, there are no, like, public offices or notary offices, as you said, that they change the surname of the wife after the husband's surname. Yeah,
it is what we mean by changing the name.
Yes.
Just as you said, when calling someone, you call by the husband's surname.
Yes.
You call a woman by her husband's surname. That's what they people mean to ask.
Yes.
When they ask such question, that's what they mean, okay?
Yes.
And they think it's... that's why they keep wondering whether it's permissible or not. But it's permissible, okay?
Yes.
Of course, the changing one's name and also her relationship to her parental relationship is not permissible because Islam respects one's lineage and one's, let's say, line of the relationship to her father, grandfather, and that must be maintained and protected.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Allah. first type of right that Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd al-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and another episode of For Humanity, where we are discussing the rights as presented by Imam Ali al-Sajjad's treatise of rights. And here we're talking about the rights of adversary. And if there is a claim, if a claim against you or a claim that you have against someone else, what kind of rights need to be observed? In our previous episodes, we were speaking about the position of a judge and how important it is for a judge or a person of justice, a person who's going to arbitrate in a conflict, what kind of qualities they need to have. And of course, that's very, very important for us to understand in this particular context. Even though Imam al-Sajjad, peace be upon him, in this particular place, he's not specifically referring to judging in the judicial system, but more your moral conduct. How on an akhlaqi level should you be relating with the other person who has a claim against you, or who you are going to have a claim against? And that's why it says, Imam al-Sajjad, peace be upon him, when he starts off this particular segment of huquq, of rights, he says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْخَصْمِ الْمُدَّعِي عَلَيْكَ, as for the rights of the adversary that has a claim against you, فَإِنْ كَانَ مَا يَدَّعِيهِ عَلَيْكَ حَقَّانَ, if that which they are claiming against you is truthful, is right, is correct, لَمْ تَنْفَسِخْ فِي حُجَّتِهِ, you should not be someone who is going to, you know, want to try to refute their evidence. What kind of evidence would you have if it's going to be something truthful? لَمْ تَنْفَسِخْ فِي حُجَّتِهِ. And also, besides the fact that you should not try to refute their evidence, at the same time, وَلَمْ تَعْمَلْ فِي إِبْطَالِ دَعْوَتِهِ, at the same time, you should not try or endeavor to invalidate or refute their claim. Instead, وَكُنْتَ خَصْمَ نَفْسِكَ لَهُ, instead, you need to be your own adversary in their advantage, in their favor. And you need to say, well, actually, you're right, you're correct, this is true, that's correct, that's what should happen in the first place. And things along these lines. And this is why, when it comes to such rights, when we're looking at it from an akhlaqi perspective and not from a judicial or legal kind of side, then where we will be able to minimize that conflict that is happening, that hostility that two people might have towards each other, two sides of a claim. Because this is going to be me as an individual trying to be just and fair and truthful and honest, even if it means it's to my disadvantage, I'm still going to be truthful, I'm still going to be honest, I'm still going to be fair. Now, we're just going to go for a short break and we will be back very, very soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And while we were speaking about the issue of being fair and making sure that we have the utmost level of justice when it comes to dealing with things ourselves on a moral level, if someone says something against us, or if someone has a claim against us, and that claim is truthful, that claim is correct, that claim is valid, then I need to uphold my traits, my qualities, and be honest about all of this. The goal that Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has, the objective that he has in wanting to present this kind of explanation is he wants to elevate you, the human being. He wants you and I to be on a higher level as far as how we are able to deal with not only ourselves, but with other people as well. Just imagine how we would be if someone came to us and had a claim against us and we said, you know what, actually, you're right, you're correct. You know, I am going to turn myself in. I am going to, for example, condemn myself, and I am going to, you know, solve this problem and whatnot. How much chaos will this eliminate? How much hostility will this get rid of? And all levels of society need to follow this in this particular way, especially when one is dealing with their family members, with their kin. You know, sometimes there might be a misunderstanding, there might be an issue, there might be a conflict. You know, let it go. If it's something that is right, make sure that you say to them, even if it's against you, you say that, yes, this is what the case is, and I'm not going to try to refute your claim against me, you know? And this is what Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, he wants. He wants us to be the best of human beings in the way possible, to have virtue, to have merit, to try to anticipate for the best. When we read these kind of statements, we understand that Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam wants us to be fair, wants us to make sure that we implement fairness in the best way possible. If we want to perceive the role that fairness plays in our lives, we need to make sure that we observe the huquq of other people and we not wrong anyone in any kind of way possible. And that will mean that we are never going to transgress anyone's rights, because we know what the laws are, we know what the legal requirements are, and we also know what the moral way of conducting ourselves are. Even Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, I'm a human being similar to all of you. If you have something that you want to claim against me, Bismillah, come and claim it against me. Maybe I might have done something, maybe you might have done something. Or else, if we were to oversee this, then most certainly someone is going to wrong somebody else. And this can be manifested, this can be seen in the best form when you are able to implement that level of justice within yourself as a person who is interacting with those who are around you. Unfortunately, what we can see in society is people making false accusations, or what we call shahadat az-zur, false accusations, or refuting based on false grounds. That's also something that is extremely, extremely detested in Islam and dangerous for us as a society. Inshallah, we will continue on speaking about this very important element in how we are able to minimize our conflict with others, especially when it comes to adversary and the rights of the adversaries, whether it be someone making a claim against you or someone who you are making a claim against, in our further next episodes. Until then, please visit us on www.parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasuli wa ali nabiyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
Inside Israel.
About half of secular Israelis, 48%, are unwilling to live alongside Haredim or ultra-Orthodox Jews. That's according to a poll conducted by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel. According to the poll, 69% of secular Israelis said they would rather have Arab neighbors than Haredi ones. This, as another 62% said they would rather live next to Bedouins, who are also Palestinian descendants, than with the ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Well, the situation is not very exciting. It's not very... we didn't choose it, but it happened. I mean, quite a few times in the year, in every year, all the time there is, you know, opportunities when the secular and the non-secular have, you know, very complicated discussions between each other. And with the corona, we've seen it so many times, and I hope it's going to go down, but it looks that you know, that there is a big wall between the secular people and the non-secular people.
This is a record high of hostility towards the ultra-Orthodox community in Israel. According to the author of the study, Dr. Gali Sambira, there's no doubt that the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. The secular Israelis who identify themselves as liberals are only liberal towards the sectors that are convenient for them, the study noted. For example, they are liberal towards Arabs, but not towards the ultra-Orthodox Jews. This, while traditional Israelis are liberal towards religious Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox. Each group considers itself to be liberal. Apparently, the coronavirus pandemic also increased the polarization. 74% of Haredim reported that the situation has become worse towards them. They feel it in real life as well. One respondent to the survey said, "If I cough on the bus, I feel like a hired assassin. If a Haredi gets on the bus, he immediately feels like an enemy to the people." The results of the poll showed the evident polarization between different sectors in Israel. Among the different groups in Israel, the greatest tension exists between the ultra-Orthodox and secular Israelis. Secularism is the point of contention between Zionists and the ultra-Orthodox community inside and outside of Israel. Many in Israel, and of course across the world, wrongly believe that Zionism is a part of Judaism, or is compatible with Judaism, or is even the main part of Judaism. All of those are actually false, according to ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro. Zionism was created to negate Judaism. Zionism was created to replace Judaism. The differences between Judaism and Zionism are vast and profound. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Shira on Twitter says, "I guess I've always thought I was very familiar with those rifts. Like, I thought the main Orthodox secular rift was between the Haredim and secular Israelis. But I didn't realize how much animosity there was between secular Israelis and the group I most identify with, Dati Leumi." Genesis says, "They are very secular, though, and this often puts them at odds with other right-wing parties because they think the Hasidic Haredim should do their military service just like other Israelis." Gil says, "Israeli society has an aggressive counter-push to it between Haredim and secular authorities. I've only seen it up close a few times, but it's scary on both sides."
Hey, each time that there is a trial, that he must stand for a trial, he's not coming, or he's making a closer for Israel or something. And we are really mad at him.
Okay, well, the question here is what the definition of Judaism and Jews is. Basically, Judaism is a religion, a pure religion, the service of Almighty God, the practice of the commandments of the Torah, the Jewish requirements, versus the new nationalistic political movement, Zionism, which drops everything holy and everything attached to God. One of the basics of Judaism is a concept that Jewish people are in exile for 2,000 years. We are forbidden to fight other nations. Then we have this new movement which fights for their nationalism and for their country. These people from the very beginning are embarrassed by traditional Judaism. They didn't want to see this continuing. They don't want to see this in their way. But still and all, we are here. Our communities are strong. We are loyal to God. We don't fight our neighbors. We practice our religion. And this is unappreciated by them. From the very beginning, they attempted and they did all in their ability to uproot Judaism, the belief in God, from the masses of the Jewish people. Aside of their movement, who are people that unfortunately left Judaism for a long time, they attempted to uproot Judaism from the remaining communities in the Holy Land, or those who immigrated to the Holy Land. They did everything they could to impose their lifestyle and their beliefs and their approach upon everyone. They hoped that Jewish tradition would no longer continue, but thank God they were unsuccessful. They are unsuccessful. Well, unfortunately, the mainstream media in Israel, as in so many other parts of the world, are on the other side, are on the side of the secular people in Israel. Unfortunately, they don't respect the community that lived in the Holy Land way before Zionism and this new movement came up to the Holy Land. They don't respect the serious communities in the Holy Land, the serious leadership of our communities, and you know, all these communities are totally disregarded, not respected, and basically oppressed.
Much of the ultra-Orthodox community considers itself anti-Zionist. Much of the friction between the secular community and the ultra-Orthodox community revolves around the definition of Judaism and what Zionism means for both groups. The propaganda that Zionists have churned out for the past 100 years have confused and conflicted Zionism and Judaism. The average person thinks that Israel is the Jewish so-called state and that Zionism is Judaism and wouldn't know the difference. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is political, and it is also national. According to Judaism, Jewish identity is completely religious. Thus, a Jew, by definition, is somebody who accepted the Jewish religion, or somebody that is defined by the Jewish religion as a Jew. According to Zionism, however, Jewish identity is political, and it is defined the same way that would define any nationalist, like a Canadian or a Frenchman. According to Zionism, Jewish identity is centered around a nation-state which they randomly decided is the nation-state that was incepted in 1948 onto Palestinian lands that they call Israel. So you can see that the differences are immense, and the friction has been there since the inception of Palestinian lands in 1948 and has only grown far apart. The latest poll by the Aluma Equality Advocacy Group and the ERI Research Institute in Israel on the tension between secular Israelis and the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community only confirms this schism. On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Baruch on Twitter says, the same way the Israeli left and secular parties uses Haredim as a boogeyman to galvanize their electorate, they use the settlers. We have huge budgets. We upset the Arabs and the world. We're fanatics. What type of kippah do secular Israeli politicians wear when they're at a religious ceremony or place? I've noticed that often left-wing politicians use knitted kippahs, customary among the religious Zionists, and right-wing politicians put black kippahs, like the ultra-Orthodox Haredim. Brian says, you must admit that it's a similar thing going on in secular Israeli minds when Haredim start moving into their neighborhoods, and they begin to worry that the Haredim will start demanding that shops close on Shabbat, no driving on the street, etc.
It was certainly not done for the peaceful, religious, God-fearing community that lived in the Holy Land way before this movement came. This was not done for refugees from the Holocaust, who are seriously religious people and very strongly opposed the movement of Zionism even before the Holocaust. This was done for the people who dropped Judaism for a long time and insisted that they want to have a sovereign homeland for themselves, which happens to be in total contrast to Judaism and Jewish tradition. And they forced so many people to go along with their philosophy. Unfortunately, so many refugees from the Holocaust that didn't have any other choice, and they were like almost forced to immigrate to the Holy Land. This was not in favor of so many people who could have had so many other alternatives, and unfortunately they were forced to the Holy Land against their will. Now, to make this very clear, this is not in favor of the Jewish people as a whole. This is not in favor of God or God's religion. This is in favor of a community of people who decided to drop God and drop Jewish religion and do their political movement on the account of so many people, Jewish and non-Jewish alike. Okay, religious Jews follow God, believe in God, believe in the basics of Jewish belief, practice the Jewish religion, the commandments, 613 commandments of the Holy Torah, One of the basics of Jewish belief is that we are in exile and we are forbidden to fight other nations. We are required to live in peace with our neighbors, not to harm or, God forbid, kill anyone. On the other side, we have the Zionist movement, which is the, generally speaking, the secular movement of Israel in general terms, who don't practice Judaism, don't believe in God. As I say, they simply don't believe in God. This was from the very beginning of Zionism to the present day. Masses of Jewish people, unfortunately, and they have nothing in their way to continue to support their national movement and their state of Israel, which they believe and they insist to call it, to call this a Jewish state. They would oppress other people, as unfortunately we see already for decades,